WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it's really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome to Monday Night Talk. My name's Kevin Tachi. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk. What is that? I did not order any applause. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. We have a fantastic show. And it's actually, it's too bad you don't have Cool in the Gang. I think it's Cool in the Gang. Do you have Ladies Night? That was Cool in the Gang, right? I think it was. As it is an all exceptional ladies night here on Monday Night Talk. And of course, we get the band back together, actually in person. I know we did something last year, earlier this year.
Last year.
Where we had the law firm of Sullivan, Lanatra, and Moschino, where we've done.
Did I hear my name?
Yes, you did. Come on in.
As you hear, the band is tuning up in the background. They're gonna actually be our number one exclusively. The whole first hour.
Wow.
Is nothing but Sullivan, Lanatra, and Moschino.
It's funny. I actually was looking through my Facebook, ladies, and we did this back on June 3rd, 2019. The three of us
in
person. It was the last time we were in person together.
Yeah.
With Kevin.
Yeah. But we did do something.
We did a Zoom.
We did like a Zoom.
A Zoom thing, just to kind of keep our chops.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have a fantastic time for the first hour.
Yes.
Second hour's we're not letting off the gas pedal, as we are going to speak with Michelle McGrath, who's the managing director of the South Shore Children's Chorus, as well as Kirsten Oberoy. She is the founding artistic director. And we're going to talk about the mission and what's going on with children singing. Fantastic. And then we're going to close things out with a really, really cool book and a really cool author. M. Patricia Diaz, author of Pretty Girls Don't Get Cancer. And this is a young lady who, at the age of 16, was told that she had stage 4 cancer.
Wow.
And it was terminal.
Oh, my gosh.
And here we are 30 years later, and she's written a book about surviving and how she had to make some significant life changes. And so she is going to join us at 7:30. Now, Ben, how much time do I have before we do traffic? Do I have a little bit more time, or do we want to do early traffic? How do you want to do this?
I'd say you got about another 2 minutes and we can roll in the traffic.
Oh, good. So if we have only 2 minutes, ladies, if you don't mind. So Kevin was actually awarded a thing in Abington as Abington's best award, and I unfortunately did not have a citation for him at that moment, so I just would like to give one today, if that is okay, ladies.
Absolutely. It's
wonderful. It is for Abington, so I do apologize, but you know, where we're going to be here live, I'd really like to
recognize. I'm glad this is radio, because I feel I'm turning up 3 or 4 shades of red right now.
I always turn red, even if it's not for me.
Okay.
So if I can, I'm going to read the citation here. Be it hereby known to all that the Massachusetts House of Representatives offers its sincere congratulations to Kevin Tachi in recognition of being awarded the Abington's Best Award and your tireless work to ensure our communities had up-to-date information during the COVID-19 pandemic. The entire membership extends its very best wishes and expresses the hope for future good fortune and continued success in all your endeavors. Given this 19th day of July 2021 at the State House of Boston, signed by Speaker Ronald Mariano and offered by State Representative myself, Allison Sullivan.
Wow.
Congratulations. Wonderful.
I don't know what to say. I just do what I do. This is, it's real.
It's real.
I see so many other people who get this. This is awesome.
And like, I wish I was able to give it to you at the Board of Selectmen's meeting, but I thought having the ladies here and being able to present it to you, I think it was
it's more special with all of us here.
That's right. Great.
The law firm here.
That's right.
It's so much better. Wow. Do we really have to do traffic? Why don't we do traffic and then we come right back? And this is fantastic. Thank you so much, Representative Sullivan. And thank you, ladies, for being here as part of the...
Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely.
Part of the tonight's conversation. Why don't we slide into finding out what's happening out on the roadways one final time today. Brought to you by Brennan's Smoke Shop. Online at BrennansSmokeShopMA.com. Actually, that's wrong. It's BrennansSmokeShop.com. So I corrected myself. With locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now Hudson, New Hampshire.
And well, thanks, award-winning Kevin Tocci.
Thank you.
The expressway northbound is stalled out from Mass Ave up through the O'Neill Tunnel to the Dacom Bridge, and along the way, crash at the Government Center exit. Southbound slow from Furnace Brook to the split, Route 3 South. You're on the brakes from the expressway to Union Street. 93 South is busy from Route 37 to Route 24. Route 24 South, that's sluggish from 93 to the Horse Bridge. This report is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. At Whole Foods Market, get 35% off ice cream and frozen treats through July 20th, plus an extra 10% off for Prime members while supplies last. Learn more in the Whole Foods Market app. Traffic on the 9s every morning. I'm Lisa DeMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
Mallory, this has been like the best, worst summer ever.
Why do you say that, Jeffrey?
The weather.
Oh, yeah, the weather.
Mm-hmm.
The boat sure looks great in the backyard.
The retro 1987 Quadrajet 350 Mark Cruiser.
That's not currently working.
What about playing your cousin's golf tournament?
It did not stop raining.
All
the entire day. Well, Jeff, at least it was close to the new Brennan Smoke Shop in Hudson, New Hampshire.
That's what makes it the best worst summer ever. Hudson, New Hampshire, Brennan Smoke Shop.
Your pal Joe Healy just installed the signs.
My pal from high school, Mass Sign and Decal. Well, this is New England, and honestly, I thought commuting to New Hampshire every day in the rain was going to be a big deal, but it's really not that far.
It's really not that bad of a ride.
It's really not that long of a ride to tax-free Hudson, New Hampshire.
Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in the world. Customers must be 21 years of age or older, and as always, proper ID is required.
Have a better summer.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tocci, on 95.9 WATD.
Benjamin, you get an extra star this evening.
Oh, boy.
As it is Ladies Night here on Monday Night Talk, 95.9 WATD. And we kick off the show in style as we have the South Shore's best when we talk about the state representatives. Great group of representatives, but this is kind of, I call it fondly, the law firm of Sullivan, Lenatra, and Moschino. And credit to Representative Sullivan, who I saw a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, now that we're kind of, you know, on the other side of COVID, maybe it's time to kind of get the group together. And I think the last couple of times we've done this, I think we've had a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So we couldn't wait to get back. You know, Matt Moratori might be jealous if he's listening right now that he's not here.
Too bad. So sad. Too bad, Matt. We had fun on Zoom, too.
Yes.
It's much better to be in person.
It is.
Absolutely. So now, how is life for each of you returning to normal, whether it's being able to be within your districts and talk face-to-face with your constituents? We'll start with you, Representative Moschino.
Actually, I had office hours today at the Hull Senior Center. It was so wonderful to actually see everyone's actual smiles and to just be in their presence. It was great. No real issues to solve, but just nice to be present and reassuring. And it's very reassuring to be with people again. So yeah, it's been great. And I feel like my district anyway is just aching to be back in person, and all of the events that have been coming up have been awesome. It's been a lot of fun. It's been really nice.
Representative Lenatra.
I will echo that. I will also say the calendar is extremely full with events that everybody has been putting, postponing until now, which has been wonderful. I've started constituent hours as well as at our senior centers, and we're back to bingo, which is huge in Kingston. So I'm back to calling bingo once a month. And that is wonderful, but it is great to be with my friends and my colleagues and all my constituents, and it's just so wonderful to actually see people. And as everyone knows, I'm Italian, so I'm a hugger to begin with. So instead of keeping my hands crossed in front of me while we had masks on so I wouldn't hug anyone, now I can actually hug people. So it's wonderful for me.
I've only played bingo a couple of times, and I won once, and that was the last time I ever did it because
I bet they were very angry.
How dare you?
That's
newbie
serious.
Winning.
Dare you.
That doesn't happen.
No. Serious business.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So I'm more of an observer when it comes to bingo, or I would call numbers. I will not.
Oh, that's no walk in the park either.
Oh, I can imagine.
2 years to break into this group. Yeah.
Really?
This is my seventh year.
Some serious people.
This is serious.
Playing 19 cards, they're daubers. You don't mess around.
But they're wonderful people.
Amen.
Yeah, wonderful people.
Representative Sullivan.
You know, I remember the first events post-COVID, I should say, or back to normal, seeing smiling faces was Firefighter Sunday. We had it at the Abington Senior Center, and being able to be in the Senior Center with everybody and no masks, it was definitely a surreal kind of feeling. You know, you took for granted having the ability to give hugs and handshakes and seeing smiling faces. And I think the pandemic kind of put us back on track to really appreciating those moments. And like my friends here said, you know, the calendar has been busy since. And I enjoy having things to do and being able to physically go somewhere instead of just on a computer and Zoom or phone.
You know, interesting enough, on the South Shore's Morning News, Rob Hackler, who you're going to get to know, Ms. Lenatra.
I am Wednesday morning. I'll be co-hosting from 6 to 10 a.m.
And so we're priming the pump here, letting you be on for almost an hour, right? Okay.
It's my practice.
And you know what's awfully interesting is our 7 o'clock guest is also going to be on tomorrow, Michelle McGrath, so very interesting. He had asked about, as far as with COVID, and, you know, we're still seeing a little bit of a resurgence because of variants. Are you a little concerned about, are you someone who likes doing a handshake or a hug, or are you a little bit cautious right about now?
I'm Italian. I got over it really quickly.
I'm not Italian, but I definitely got over it right.
I did, and I will say, I just came from an event before I came here, and I met a woman who has been vaccinated and had COVID. They call it a breakthrough. So that made me pause for a moment. But, you know, I have to live my life. I've had my vaccination. I've also had COVID. So I can't help, you know. Yeah. I'd rather hug than... And I did shake a lot of hands tonight, I will say. No more elbows.
No more elbows.
No more elbows.
I will say, though, if I've intersected with a lot of people, and there have been a few big events. I've been at Scituate had a gay pride parade. There were just tons of people there, leaps to mind. But when I've had those moments, I have put the mask back on just in an abundance of caution. And that's my signal to say to people, like, just be cautious, because I have been with a lot of people. So I've sort of been doing a little hybrid thing. Just be careful. Just to be cautious.
See, me, I'm a little cautious. If I go into a store somewhere, I'll put a mask on. Call it unusual, but I'm still kind of a little nervous.
Well, I think we all need to respect people's own opinions and their own wishes, whether it be to be a hugger or whether it be to be a mask wearer. I don't think we should criticize people for making those decisions, because we don't know what their household lives are. I know during the pandemic, I mean, I got tested. I think I became a professional COVID tester because, well, I got, you know, because of having my elderly grandfather living at my mother's house, and we took every precaution to make sure that we weren't exposing him, especially because of the job my significant other and I do, being out in the public. We just need to make sure that we were doing our best to make sure we were making sure that my family and his family were safe during the pandemic. But I don't judge people. If they want to wear a mask, I'm not one of those people that say, you know, the pandemic's over. I say post-pandemic, but because I want to move forward. I want to have normal. I want to go back to what normal life is. But the pandemic and the COVID-19 virus is still real. But I think it's time that we need to take some steps forward. You know, maybe not too many leaps, but I think it's important that we get some sense of normalcy.
So let me follow up again, talking about the variants, and do you, is there any, as policymakers, as folks who govern, has there been any semblance of a small conversation as to beware, we should be aware, just in case later on in the fall and the winter we see a resurgence, or not so much as of yet? Rep. Sullivan?
You know, I think there's always that talk. I know that the House takes the precaution requiring masks if you are in person because of some of our colleagues and their health concerns. And there is also that kind of conversation going forward within the school committees to see what the school districts are going to look like in the fall, what we're going to see in the fall, because kids will be back to school. I mean, people are taking advantage of the summer with this normalcy on traveling and being around family and loved ones, that there is that risk of what could come in the fall. But I think, you know, I speak for myself, but I think, you know, going forward, I think we're very much more prepared than we were in 2019 going into 2020. So I think if there is a surge, or if there is some situations where there's clusters, I think we'll be more prepared to handle that as a whole community in a Commonwealth than we were in 2020.
I think it was also, we learned the basics, mm-hmm. right? You know, you cover your mouth when you sneeze, you wash your hands. I mean, basic things that, and I know that they were circulating statistics for a while there that the regular flu and other colds and things like that were down because we were just remembering and sensitive to doing the basics. And I think that was a great lesson for all of us to learn, just moving forward and keeping that in the back of our minds. So, yeah.
It definitely was learning. You know, we learned so much during the pandemic. I'm concerned about the kids going back to school because mm-hmm. under 12 can still not be vaccinated. I know some of the camps are having some COVID cases emerge. I know the one in Kingston, their day camp is closed, Kingston Rec, for 2 weeks because there's been a couple instances with COVID. But, you know, we've learned a lot. As you said, the masks and the hand washing. I mean, I didn't hear of anyone that had a cold during COVID or the regular flu.
Right.
So, you know, that tells you a lot right there.
I think I was probably the only one that had a cold during COVID then.
Did you?
Oh, sorry.
Sorry about that.
I did not have a cold, and I got the flu shot when it was suggested you should get your flu shot.
Well, yeah.
I went and got my flu shot.
Yeah, see, I haven't had the flu shot. Sorry, everyone. I haven't had the flu shot in probably about 15 years.
It's a choice.
Yeah.
It's a choice.
And that's the thing. You got to respect. And, you know, the hard part is it's, you know, I think the pandemic politically, I think, separated a lot of families because of their own opinions, whether the pandemic, the virus was real, the virus wasn't real, the vaccines are good, the vaccines are bad. I think we just need to take a step back and remember what this pandemic has done and to respect people for, like, just being people. And I think going forward, you know, if you can't have a healthy conversation, I think, you know, you need to respect people's opinions, whether it be for the vaccine, against the vaccine, and what their own personal makeup is. It's a hard thing, and I see it in my family, I see it in my friends, the opposites, kind of having those discussions, but I just hope people can respect, you know.
I do, too. I think it's fear-based as well. You know, when you talk about vaccine, now I'm on the vaccine kick, right? But when you talk about vaccines, I had this conversation with a group of people at Oak Point the other day, and they were concerned about the rate of vaccinations, and they were told in their community, which is Oak Point, was 98%. And they said, well, how do we know that's the truth? I said, you don't, but you have to take precautions, and you have to respect everybody's opinion. You know, we're not talking COVID, but other vaccinations. You know, I'm getting a lot of letters now about they don't want it mandated. And I can understand the fear. We don't know. My children are vaccinated, but I did have that fear about my daughter. She had a fear. She wants to start a family when she's older, and she didn't know if this was going to be part of it. She's only 15, but she's type A and has a vision and is goals-oriented. And mm-hmm. We had to make an appointment with her doctor to make her feel comfortable with that. So you do have to respect everyone's opinion.
Oh, yeah. I think it's, you know, a tough decision, especially being younger and not mm-hmm. really knowing. You know, but also, too, when I had this conversation, I think, with people, it's, you know, you base it on, well, what's the precaution, what's the fear of the COVID-19 vaccine versus getting the COVID virus, and what's those long-term effects, you know? It's just, yeah, it's just super unknown. I'm not the professional in the medical field, so I think, you know, but we are getting those letters, mm-hmm. you know, as far as the, whether it be the mandate of it or take away the exemptions for it or not mandating the COVID-19 vaccine. I think it's definitely going to be one of the things that we are going to have to tackle this session. I think it's going to be a very emotional kind of topic going forward.
It's an interesting you talk about as far as whether to mandate in the month of September. I'm planning on getting on a boat for the first time in a couple of years.
You're brave.
Very brave. But my missus is driven. She loves cruising. We went to D.C. for a couple of days. It was just like, most of the museums were closed, but it was a breath of fresh air to be able to get out and be somewhere else, you know, other than within, you know, a couple square miles away from your own home. But I heard a news report today that cruise ships are going to, if you are not vaccinated, they're going to basically tell you to get off the boat and you will not get a refund. Now, I know that we have a cruise line, cruise lines that usually go out of Boston. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you know, we're hearing here in Boston as far as mandating that a business can mandate that or an organization can mandate that, you know, or can something be done legislatively?
Well, that is a private business. So, I mean, I always think of it as, you know, the signs, I live at the beach, right? So no shirt, no shoes, no service. So no shirt, no shoes, no vaccine, no service, or no mask, no service. I mean, I think private businesses have that ability to do that. Now, schools and the public, that's different. I think they have that. I think they have that ability to do that. So,
well, I know Curtis, and I always give a shout out to Curtis every time I'm on the air. Anyway, I don't know if he's listening right now, but I Curtis has been accepted into New England School of Law. And they are requiring everyone getting vaccinated, you know, from the faculty down to the students. So if you're not vaccinated, then you're withdrawn.
Isn't that a state school?
New England School of Law? No.
No, it is. Private. Our side.
Mm-hmm.
My bad.
Scott Brown's the president at New England now. So, yeah.
You're thinking of Mass School of Law.
Yeah.
I am. Mm-hmm.
That's in Andover.
Andover.
I'm speaking on the one in Boston.
Just making sure.
Thank you very much.
Because that was what I was thinking.
Actual lawyer on the lawyer.
Yeah. All good. Total respect to the attorney.
Thank you.
We got a couple more minutes here. So, you know, now is the budget very close to being signed by the governor?
It was signed on Friday.
It was signed. So we have a budget for 22.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We do.
How's it feel?
Oh, thank goodness. It's so much better than last session that, hey, listen, we were learning, we were going along and doing the best we could and really trying to sort of keep up and stay moment to moment. But it was so, and it worked really well last session. I really feel like it worked well and it supported everyone in the way that all of our agencies and our communities needed to be. But it's so nice to have it just done and tied off with a ribbon. He did. There were just
amendments.
A few, like
a couple million, slashes with the pen. Yeah,
just a couple $1 million. And if you read his letter, I mean, it was pretty sensible. So
it was sensible.
Yeah,
it's $7 million.
$7 million. Yeah. So nice to have that done.
And it was done in a timely fashion. I mean, you should have it. It should have been already been done by July 1st. But we know that sometimes it can spill over, and if you have to go into the 1/12th type of budgeting, well, you do that. But I mean, we're talking the middle of July, and the budget is done.
Yeah, and I mean, think about how we do the budget, right? December, you're already doing your consensus revenue, and it starts with the governor's, his House won, and then it moves its way through every step of the way. You know, it's collaboration between the legislature and the governor's office. Mm-hmm. So I never worry about the fact that it was a few weeks late because it's all in good spirits, goodwill, and collaboration. And honestly, I think it's a budget that was really about investing in people and services and mm-hmm. uplifting, especially after COVID. So I actually think it's a great budget. It's really... Plus, we put money into our stabilization account.
Which is amazing.
$5.8 million. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely...
Wait, million or billion?
Oh, excuse me, billion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Looking ahead
to... The letter is everything.
The letter is everything. So we're actually even looking ahead to, you know, what next budget cycle and what uncertainties there might be there, too. So, yeah, I thought that was great.
Yes, definitely.
And that stabilization fund came in handy during last year.
Fund,
you
right?
needed to tap mm-hmm. into that to provide essential services during COVID.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So where's it back up to now? So has it ballooned back up to about $6 billion or?
Yeah, it's just shy of $6 billion. I think we put 1.2 I think it was 1.1 we put in there, something around that line, and it got it up to 5.8 billion. I know. How do I know these things?
This is wonderful.
the strange little facts.
You're the attorney in the room.
the facts that come to your head in the moments.
Everybody else is kind of happy that this is done, and that maybe there was some residuals in it for everybody's district.
Yes, that was very nice.
Yeah. Anybody want to brag a little bit as to what you were able to get for it? You know, you don't have to go every community. Some of you have larger or have more communities.
Yes, I have six towns. As you're looking at me, I have six towns.
Folks at home can't see it, but I was.
The awkward district that you have, I can never remember.
I still think you should have been in the conversation when Fox 25 was visiting one of the communities. Just put that out there.
Well, there was one that was to speak. And
I know, but I waited up all morning to see you at least. Say hi.
Thank you, Kevin.
So, just
you were
so
the
you know.
First to send me a little text, too.
I did. I
so
like,
I appreciate
hey,
that.
When are you going to say something? Like, it's not my thing. But how did you make out as far as certain key areas that you're pushing for funding or for initiatives?
So I was able to secure money for all three towns, which was really good. I think it's important that, you know, I advocated for that, especially during the pandemic and seeing the hard-hit areas that were happening. I know the coalition in East Bridgewater was able to receive funding again, which is important for the opioid crisis because we're going to see more and more in that during this pandemic, which is very sad to see with mental health and substance abuse. And then, as far as Abington goes, we were able to secure funding for a liaison to look at our housing and our affordable housing throughout the town and making sure that we're up to the state mandates and what we're utilizing it for to make sure that we're giving Abington the best that we can give them.
I heard an interesting term called 40R. Am I in the neighborhood here?
So there's a 40B and there's a 40R, and I don't know exactly what 40R is, but I know what 40B is. So
it's 40R, like smart growth, right?
It's smart growth.
Yep.
So you can do a 40R, you can declare a 40R overlay district, yep. And it's usually the kind of thing where if you're doing certain kinds of building and you think it's going to really balloon your school district populations, there's like money back, and it's actually a really smart, sensible way to approach smart growth. It takes a lot of work, but communities that do it usually find it's really worth the while.
And I only know this much, and folks at home can't see it, but Bruce Hughes, who is on the planning board,
yes.
I know he loves stuff like that. He was Old Colony Planning Council for many, many, I think more than three decades. And I saw him last night at one of the summer concerts, and he was just gushing about he wants to have some kind of a discussion about it to better inform people about 40R and its benefits. How about you, Representative?
Oh, I was very fortunate. So I secured some money for the Nathan Hale Veterans Outreach, which services actually my entire district and the South Shore, which is wonderful. Chris and Diane Hart do a wonderful job there. The Plymouth Area Coalition is getting some funds for their food pantry, which is wonderful because I volunteered there twice a week during the pandemic, and it's really well needed for some updates there. In the Kingston Business Association, our small businesses in the town of Kingston were really suffering, so they received some money. And then the little town of Plimpton. Yes, I love the little town of Plimpton.
Still hand counts.
So they received some money as well.
That's your punishment as a new cub reporter as you go to Plimpton for the votes on election night.
Oh, I think that's charming. I love that.
It is charming, especially at 2 o'clock in the morning when they finally get done.
Oh, wow.
God bless them. Mm-hmm. How about you, Representative Moschino?
I went in sort of a different direction. I was actually advocating for state libraries, in particular the regional distribution networks and the technology, because if you really think about what we were struggling with and what mm-hmm. we needed, so we were able to get that line item up. I wish I could remember the number off the top of my head now, but I took the lead on advocating for that, and we were able to get that fully funded, which was exciting.
That's exciting and important.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very important.
It's huge. So in the grand scheme of the budget, it's like a small investment, but boy, what you unlock with that and the ability to lend and to really to make sure that the technology and the databases are available for online research was huge. The other one that I was also advocating for was Division of Ecological Restoration, because of course, you know, we can't talk unless we're talking about the climate and the environment. And what this does is it staffs the Division of Ecological Restoration to remove dams and really help to restore watersheds and the health, which is part of our resilience and our sustainability on the South Shore in particular. So that's a huge one for my district in particular. They really avail themselves of that all of that technical assistance. So yeah, so I went in a slightly different direction. Did that.
Well, fantastic, and congratulations to all of you for working hard on behalf of your district and your constituents, because it's important to know that someone is actually up doing work, and not to say that nobody isn't, but you know, this. They're usually the regular Joe. They're like, you know, oh, what has my local representative done for me? This is a perfect example. And all the representatives who come in, whether they're on this program, whether they're doing something with the news department or any other program, takes the time to discuss what it is and the transparency. That's the other thing is you all here on the South Shore provide transparency, and that's very important.
I think it is. It's very important for our constituents, and it's very important also to see for our constituents to see that we all work together. We all work, you know, because Allison is...
Oh, so you're saying that we don't get along?
You know, so regardless of what party we're in, we all work together for the best of our districts and the best of the Commonwealth. So it's important for the citizens of the Commonwealth to see that and not see just what's on the federal side, but to know in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we all work together and we work well.
With that, we are going to step aside just for a moment. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, also 1460 WBMS. When we come back, more of Sullivan, Lenatra, and Moschino in just a few moments.
Are you worried about your drinking?
Or is someone else worried about your drinking?
Alcoholics Anonymous has a solution.
There is no shame in living with a disease called alcoholism.
Regardless of your age, employment, or any other circumstances in your life, you deserve help from other individuals who understand what you are going through. Alcoholics Anonymous is here for you 24/7 at AA.org. Find online meetings at AABoston.org.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Go ahead, indulge yourself. Every Wednesday night, tune in to Talk with Francesca and join me for provocative conversation, intriguing stories, and inspiration. So sit back and relax, or be stimulated, or both. Because being connected feels good. It's contagious, and I personally want to spread it around.
Don't miss Talk with Francesca, Wednesday nights at 9 on 95.9 WATD. Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, yeah, just a reminder, our number two are Michelle McGrath and Kirsten Oberoy from the South Shore Children's Chorus, as well as M. Patricia Diaz, author of Pretty Girls Don't Get Cancer. That's coming up, our number two. But we're closing out our number one strong, and we give the ladies an opportunity. State Representative Joan Moschino and Kathy Lenatra and Allison Sullivan a chance to kind of talk about some of the bills or anything that they got in the works that of great importance, maybe to them, to their constituents. We'll go with Representative Lenatra. We'll go with you first.
Oh, thank you.
You and I had talked. I gave each of you an opportunity to kind of share as to what you want to talk about. I know there are a couple of key pieces of legislation that you've got in the works at this
particular
time. Yes,
Kevin, there is. This one's very timely. It's the voter safety bill. It's actually a refile of mine from last session. And if anybody's been watching the news, they've seen in the past week there's been three atrocious boat accidents. What this bill will do is it will require a voter safety class before you actually
pilot a watercraft. As it is right now, you could have some money and go and buy a 35-foot boat, never have been on the water before, and put that boat in the water and just go. We need our license for a car, and a car has brakes, a boat does not. Right. I was fortunate enough to grow up with a family that had a boat, so I took that course when I was probably 14, and all four of my children have actually taken it as well. It's not a hard course. It's very simple. It's not costly. You can actually take it for free, but it's more of a safety issue, and it was drafted because of an incident that actually happened in Kingston to a young gentleman, so it's actually the David Hansen Act, and that is... Really, after I've watched the news for the past 3 weeks, I'm really pushing that bill to go through this year. And during the pandemic, actually, boat sales were increased about 45%.
Oh, wow.
So that's huge. Yeah. And it's very difficult to purchase a boat right now. So think of all those boats that are actually on the water during the time. I haven't been out at all this year, but last year I was out during the pandemic, and it was horrifying. You know, it was really scary to be out in the water with family. I felt very unsafe. And the other bill I would like to highlight is mental health. So mental health is really a passion of mine, and in releasing the stigma on what's going on. And, you know, during the pandemic, I think it's really come to the forefront of how many people are suffering with some mental health issues, more so than pre-pandemic. And this is, it just focuses on law enforcement itself. You know, this is a bill for critical incidents. If a law enforcement officer has been through a critical incident, that they're getting the care, the wellness care that they need and is required. And it sets it up in a way that everybody receives that same care. So the way it would stand now, you say you have a progressive chief that's really into that, yes, you need this wellness care, we are going to take this step, and you may have a chief that is more towards the old school, where it's like, you know, suck it up, buttercup, like, this is the way it goes. So what this would do is to make ensure that, like many other states have, that officer really gets the care that they need. Because, you know, when you think about it, we have the police reform bill that happened, but, you know, hurt people. So if our officers can get the care after they've been to a critical incident, I think it will make for better officers.
What would be some of the residuals that are in that particular bill as far as help? Would it provide monies for individuals to be able to go seek help? I mean, what would it do?
It would be a certain, so it would not be somebody in their department, right? It would be somebody outside.
So would it go off of what's already kind of in place that's available to them? So there's already, you know, a system
there
in
is.
Place. It's just a voluntary type of system in some departments where, like Kathy said, there's some chiefs that are suck it up buttercup, and then there's other ones that are like, you're going to this meeting with this group or this individual. Well, I think, like Kathy said, you know, I think between the police reform bill, COVID-19 pandemic, and then our communities being hit hard during, you know, in Braintree with the officers involved shootings, right. And, you know, we can't think it's not going to happen here, because it's already happened here, you know, in 2018, and then now with Canine Kit, and I think we need to be aware of what our officers are seeing day in and day out, and you know, what people don't see on the news all the time is they show up and they see little children dead, or they show up and see, you know, someone that looks like them or their family members, and to be able to really decompress them into a point where they're getting the help and care they need, I think that's a great piece of legislation to put it across the board and make sure that they're getting that opportunity to be able to seek that help without any negative criticism or
exactly.
potential for termination and or, you know, getting rubber gunned, so to speak, and,
right.
and not being able to do their job, because I think a lot of officers can use this benefit to be better officers.
Did you co-sign on to that?
I think I did. Okay. I think I did. If I didn't, Curtis,
you did.
Know, we
you
gotta
did.
Make
I'm
sure.
You did.
Because, you know, I see it in my community. You know, we had an officer who committed suicide in 2018. And he was an individual who reached out for help, and unfortunately, he wasn't able to secure that help, and he took his own life. And, you know, what we need to do is we need to look after the people that are looking after us. And I think that's a great piece of legislation.
Thank you.
You know, I definitely...
It's well needed.
It is.
It's well needed. And just Allison and I both share someone that are both on law enforcement, and most of the calls they go on are mental health calls.
Mm-hmm.
I would say 85%. Our mental health calls. So you never know. You never know. So this would actually, I think, would be very helpful if it's mandatory.
Yeah. I agree.
Oh, even think of the trauma of an overdose, right? You mm-hmm, come mm-hmm. someone that dies right there in front of you, mm-hmm. or a car accident. And I can remember someone died from, recently I just read about a motorcycle. You know, and it's just, you know, if you're the person, if you're the first person on scene, that's tough.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
A lot of trauma.
Yeah. And what do they do with that? You know, they bottle it up. So this will right, hopefully
or
help
they
them.
Or they try to, you know, disassociate themselves of it, you know, mm-hmm. almost like that they're neutralized to it. You know, my significant other is a police officer in the city of Brockton, and he's seen his fair share, I think, right. Of traumas. But it's also those smaller communities that think it's not going to happen to them, and it happens to them. You know, I represent Abington, Whitman, East Bridgewater, and I guarantee all those officers have seen their fair share of tragedies. I know we have one in Abington where a whole family was murdered by their father in white and right. a husband. So, you know, there were young officers that responded to that. I mean, one of the officers, I think, was only on for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And he's a young kid. Seeing little children in that kind of state, it does. Even on a seasoned officer.
Right. Even on a seat, especially if they have a family they're going home to.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it was actually brought to me from an officer that was in a restaurant off duty, and he was carrying his off-duty weapon, I guess I should say, and someone came into that restaurant and started shooting up the restaurant.
Wow.
And he had his gun on him and was able to get him down and waiting for, you know, the police department to come, and that really affected him, and he really needed help, and he didn't feel that he got the help that he needed, but he did eventually get it. So I've had long conversations with him. I've had long conversations with chiefs that have lost some of their officers to suicide and wish that they had seen it sooner and wish they had done something sooner. So
that was great legislation.
Thank you, Allison.
You're welcome.
And if you're tuned in, we got a couple more minutes left with our state representatives, Representative Moschino. Anything you want to share on any bills that you got in the works?
Well, I know the one you want to talk about.
Absolutely. I wish we had a lot of time because the
streaming services bill.
Yes.
Well, basically what this is we have public access channels that we all rely on, the cable TV, for all of our, you know, school committee and our select board meetings and all of the programming that they do that was so hugely important during the pandemic. And as people are leaving cable,
cutting that cord.
Mm-hmm. What's happening is the revenues are diminishing. It's really compromising the cable station's ability, our local cable, to do the programming. So what we're going to do is we're going to propose to wrap in these other types of service providers into a small fee that they will, just like our cable companies do right now, to support all of the public access programming that we're doing. And it's hugely important, and we learned that really, especially as people are isolated at home, that was sort of the only sort of outlet and trusted news source and good, fun, interesting, cultural music, all the great programming and stuff. And it's the stuff that we rely on heavily to get our message out as well. So
who wouldn't want to watch a 3-hour town meeting?
I should have waited to give the citation after that
right,
one, you know?
That's right. Oh, my God, there's still stuff that plays in Hull that people will say, oh, there was one that always plays around your routes to Hull. And every time it plays, someone will pull me aside and be like, I saw you. So a lot of that programming is really important, and it's really vibrant, and it's, you know, and people watch. So mm-hmm.
they do watch.
So we're trying to find them a more stable revenue source, and it would be good for both. The town would get some of the revenue, and then the local cable provider would get some of the revenue as well. So, yeah.
Nice.
Excellent. Bravo. That's two for two, Representative Sullivan.
So as many know, I do focus a lot on my kind of goals around domestic violence, being a survivor myself. And so I filed two pieces of legislation. One would give a commission to oversee what our state-funded and our sexual assault domestic violence coalitions are doing. Because what we've seen during the pandemic was a lack of resources or the inability to get resources because of the shutdown. So that was definitely a struggle for me, knowing what I went through in isolation. And then to think if that was during a pandemic, how much more traumatic that would be because of not having outlets of work or school or what have you. And then another piece of legislation would put out like a statewide mandate and kind of having this minimum bar that these service providers would have to maintain in order to be accredited, quote unquote, to be able to provide services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Because I think you should be able, no matter where you live in the state of Massachusetts, you should be able to get at least the same minimum standard of care and the opportunities that you could get if you're in, you know, whether it be a bigger city or an area that has, you know, we have great resource centers here, and an advocate that I need to just give a little bit of a shout out, Karen Fabrizio, who is an amazing advocate here in the South Shore. She's based out of Plymouth, and she was my go-to during this pandemic when I had constituents reaching out across the Commonwealth going through domestic violence or sexual violence in their homes.
Hugely important. Hugely important.
It is.
So disappointed. We should have made this a two-hour show.
Next time. Next time.
Really? I mean, yeah, you guys deserve, well, you said it earlier, Rep. Lenatrice, you guys deserve your own show.
Hey.
I think so. Why not?
I think it'd be good.
I'm ready to pitch it.
Hey, we'll do it.
And I'm sure Uncle Eddie would love it. Anything, we just got like 2 minutes left. Anything that, any stone we haven't turned over, but you want to take a moment to talk about?
You know, I just want to thank our boards of health, our first responders in our communities.
Amen.
I think they did a fantastic job on handling the beginning of this pandemic and the vaccine rollouts. I wish they had the ability to, at the very beginning of the vaccine rollouts, had the resources and the vaccines to be able to do it locally. But they fought through, and they really, I mean, those heroes that kind of remain nameless shouldn't be nameless. You know, I think they really stepped up to the plate during what we could never expect to happen. So I just want to say thank you to all those guys and girls and ladies that did a fantastic job.
Know, there's a bill on that. Denise Garlick on the House, Rep. Garlick, she filed a bill to better support our public health systems because they deserve resources, because they were there for us front and center every step of the way. And we think about all of the people who came together around food insecurity and delivering meals both to the elderly as well as to families.
Sure.
I mean, there was tons of work that they just selflessly did. So it wasn't even just around things like, around the vaccinations. It was so much more.
What I saw, because we had a vaccine clinic in Abington, and I just saw so many people just rally together. You know, I had nurses in the community volunteering their time. You had teachers volunteering their time. You had first responders volunteering their time. And just all those people that came together just to try to better the community. And then, as you said, like the food supply source, and I had a young lady, Claire LaMattina, who is Rainey LaMattina, Sleckman and Whitman's daughter, come up with this
fundraiser.
Whitman Strong fundraiser.
Yeah.
And this campaign that kind of just spread. You know, Abington ended up doing it, East Bridgewater ended up doing it, and I know other surrounding communities started doing it. Where they put up these signs, and she collected money, and 100% of the money raised went to the food pantries. And what people don't realize is that a dollar at the food pantry goes a longer way than a dollar at the food store. So it's like, when I talked to her mom, it was almost up to $20,000 that she raised.
Wonderful.
It was, last I knew, it was around $16,000.
Yeah.
It started out with a handful of signs.
Right.
Yeah. And
she, out of pocket, she grabbed, 100 signs, thinking she'd only do 100, and then it went bananas. It did, and she did a fantastic job, and, she didn't do it for recognition, and she didn't do it for any type of, thank you. She just did it because she knew there were going to be families that were struggling that probably never struggled a day in their life, and that found themselves, reaching out to the food pantries in their town, so... kudos to her. She was, I think a freshman at the time when she did it. So think of that, those young minds that
think
are just
of those
really,
young minds.
That are just stepping up to the plate, especially during something like this.
The next future state representatives?
Yeah, maybe.
Awesome. Hopefully.
We got a few of those in our district.
Yeah. I mean, civic engagement, that's what this is. Volunteer spirits, whether you're elected, appointed, or you just step forward and volunteer, that's what civic engagement in your community really means.
Yeah.
And it's so hugely important. And it really showed, at least down to the South Shore in our districts anyway.
Oh, yeah. We got a great community down here on the South Shore.
Yeah, we really do.
Second to none. Same with their representatives. I want to thank you ladies for joining me and coming in studio, and thank you, Representative Sullivan, for the citation and all your other colleagues up at the House, and Rep. Moschino and Lenatra. Are we going to do this again? Maybe we do this in 5 or 6 weeks?
Sure.
Sounds
on the onset of the fall?
Yeah, that'd be great. We want to hear about your cruise.
I know. Where are you going? Did you say where you were going?
Yeah, I think we're going to be going to California, and sailing out of San Francisco, and hitting a couple of ports down the coast, and gonna end up in Mexico somewhere.
Nice, pretty
wonderful.
Oh, I'm jealous.
We did an Alaskan cruise.
Not on the boat yet, so
we did an Alaskan cruise a couple of years back. Beautiful. So, if she likes cruises and you haven't done it yet, you got to do it.
I suspect you might. My stepdaughter and her husband actually went on a similar cruise.
Yeah.
And they said it was beautiful.
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 Yeah. I mean, you got to pack for all seasons because you never know what you're going to get.
It's Alaska. So, ladies, thank you so much for joining
me.
Thank you.
It's wonderful, Kevin, to be here. Thank you for having us in.
You got it. Folks, that concludes. I'm sad. It's the first hour of Monday Night Talk is in the books. But fear not. We're going to put a smile back on your face for hour number two. Coming up in just a moment, Michelle McGrath and Kirsten Oberoi joining us from the South Shore Children's Chorus. I almost couldn't spit that out. Coming up in just a moment here on Monday Night Talk, heard on 95.9 WATD.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
If you want a drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's for Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is an inclusive fellowship of individuals all around the world. The one thing you need to ask yourself is, am I ready to do something about my drinking problem? For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, go to AA.org. To find a meeting near you, call 617-426-9444 or visit aaboston.org.
Mallory, this has been, like, the best, worst summer ever.
Why do you say that, Jeffrey?
The weather.
Oh, yeah, the weather.
Mm-hmm.
The boat sure looks great in the backyard.
The retro 1987 Quadrajet 350 Mark Cruiser.
That's not currently working.
What about playing your cousin's golf tournament?
It did not stop raining.
All
the
day.
The entire day. Well, Jeff, at least it was close to the new Brennan Smoke Shop in Hudson, New Hampshire.
That's what makes it the best worst summer ever. Hudson, New Hampshire, Brennan Smoke Shop.
Your pal Joe Healy just installed the signs.
My pal from high school, Mass Sign and Decal. Well, this is New England, and honestly, I thought commuting to New Hampshire every day in the rain was going to be a big deal, but it's really not that far.
It's really not that bad of a ride.
It's really not that long of a ride to tax-free Hudson, New Hampshire.
Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in the world. Customers must be 21 years of age or older, and as always, proper ID is required.
Have a better summer.
Plymouth 400 Inc. continues their mission of education and commemoration of the 400th anniversary of Plymouth's founding with a new television series called Plymouth 400 Conversations. The program will focus on authors, filmmakers, artists, and poets who discuss how the 400th anniversary commemoration influenced their work. Each episode premieres Thursday nights at 7:30 on PAC-TV, but available online for everyone to see the following day. Despite the pandemic, the 400th anniversary commemoration continues into 2021 with great virtual programming now, including this fascinating new virtual series, and live events later in the year. See what Plymouth 400 Inc. has scheduled. Shop for Plymouth 400 anniversary merchandise to share with friends and family, and catch the most recent episode of Plymouth 400 Conversations. Visit Plymouth400Inc.org.
Buying, selling, or trading in a car? Learn from the experts how to make the process work for you. Tune into the Boss Auto Show every Saturday after the news at noon on 95.9 WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Keep on my ass, no pick up the run. Love all the vodka.
because you are hearing the South Shore Children's Chorus. I believe that might be the intermediate group. And we have joining us Michelle McGrath, who I can make responsible for this particular segment. And joining her, I believe, is the founding artistic director. And don't shoot me yet, Kirsten Oberoi.
You got it.
Okay. Otherwise, we would have called you Kirsten. We don't want to do that. So, ladies, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you.
And, of course, this is priming the pump for you, Michelle, because yes. You'll be back tomorrow.
Yeah, it's almost like I'm having a sleepover here.
It is. It's kind of it's like a dress rehearsal.
Yes, there
right?
you go.
These are things not to do when you're on the air tomorrow with the South Shore's Morning News with Rob Hakala. So, welcome. First, let's get a little history lesson here. Mm. Talk to us about the children's chorus. Kirsten. I caught myself.
Absolutely. Well, in 2016, in January, I founded the South Shore Children's Chorus. I am a native of Quincy. I grew up there. I went to the schools there, and I loved to sing, but there was no opportunity for a children's chorus in kind of that area. It was all in the city. And because I had two working parents, I wasn't able to kind of get in the city, so I wasn't able to have that opportunity. So when I moved back in 2015, 2016, I realized that I was really passionate about offering something awesome, a really joyful experience in singing for kids where I grew up. And the passion just kind of grew from there. I found other people like me who care about this community and care about the music education in this community, and it grew from there.
Interesting enough, we have she is now the managing director.
That's true.
Now, we know you because you were on the show not too long ago.
Yes.
As, I think, a best-selling author.
I was. I know. It's been a busy year.
No. You are. There's no was.
Still am. Thank you.
How did it come to be that you are the managing director?
Well, I have the privilege to expand my role with South Shore Children's Chorus, because as you know, I own a public relations business that mm-hmm. serves the arts primarily in nonprofits. And South Shore Children's Chorus has been a client of mine for a number of years now. And so we, Kirsten had this opening, and I already do some services for her that actually would married together with the role that she was looking to fill would be a perfect fit for a managing director position. So it's just I'm just stepping a little further into the organization, and it's, you know, the arts and children is my passion, is making sure that they get educated in music and so many, my kids included, are, you know, all were educated that way and are singers and play instruments, and it makes a big difference in their lives. So.
Now, is this coming back slowly post-COVID, and how is it going, Michelle?
So most of the arts organizations I am working with in my PR business are primarily resuming rehearsals this fall. But Kirsten was so smart and planned her annual summer intensive camp last week at Stonehill College. And it was perfect timing because everything is already, you know, all of the restrictions are lifted, and all of those students and the educators that are on their staff, it is just amazing to watch the joy that came out of those kids and adults last week. It was time.
Now, any level, I mean, can, let's say my kid is 8 years old and wants to learn to sing, is there a way for my 8-year old to be able to come in, or do they already have to have some training?
Absolutely not. They do not have to have any training. So at South Shore Children's Chorus, during our year-round program, we serve kindergarten through 12th grade. So we serve any student, any age, any ability, any experience, any financial status. We have never turned a child away to sing with us. We are very unique in the fact that children do not have to audition to come. You just sign up and show up, because I'm a firm believer that every child can sing if they want to. And so our doors are wide open for any child that wants to come and to sing with us.
So what are the different levels that are? I would think that you start out with like a training and then it advances from there?
Yes. So our training level is kindergarten through second grade. And we have some of the most amazing educators for that grade on our team, including Kelly Graber, who has been teaching for many years in Cambridge, focused on that K through second grade area. And she is out of this world with that age group and so patient and kind. And those students end up learning to sing in parts, in unison, they dance, they play games, they have such an appreciation and a joy for music at such a young age, and it's so fun to watch her kind of have that. And then our next level up is the intermediate choir level, third through sixth grade singers. And those singers learn to really sing in two parts. They're developing their voices and their musicianship all at the same time, which is really exciting. And then I mainly run the 7th through 12th grade group, the advanced choir group, which is broken down into some smaller subcategories, but it's a really joyful experience for teenagers to come together that all have a passion for the same thing. Students always tell me that they love coming to South Shore Children's Chorus because it's other kids just like them who love to sing.
When you hear the joy coming from her voice, Michelle, how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel like I made the right decision to take this part-time role on in addition to my regular company, because this is the kind of joy I want to embrace in my career. And I've always believed that people that work in the arts have to have passion about what they do. Often the arts are not very lucrative financially, but you do that work because it is so fulfilling and transformational, and in other ways other than bank accounts. And and this, you know, just to be around children again too, like my kids are all gone off and have graduated from college
they
now
grow up and they go away.
I know. And so now, you know, I got to hang out and sing myself last week with 65 students. It was amazing. We had a really wonderful time.
Wait, when do you actually age out as a child? Because if she's able to sing, if I want to get in on this.
Well, you know, pretty soon here we'll be around enough to have an alumni chorus.
Yeah,
so,
there you go.
You know.
Is it growing in the direction that you've envisioned it?
Absolutely. It has grown every year a little bit. Right before the pandemic, we were almost at 100 students from about 17 different towns in the South Shore area. And now we're coming back strong. The summer program was a really strong and really awesome way to come back. It was so fulfilling just as a human being to be there with so much happiness and joy and energy. And I just see that trickling over into fall as we continue to try and expand and reach more families with what I believe is a really, really amazing mission.
So I would ask, and that is are there after school is this an afternoon school program strictly, or is it beyond that? Are you hoping to grow beyond that?
Well, it is after school for the students that go to rehearsals on weekdays, but then there are also sometimes rehearsals on Sunday, and then an all-ensemble rehearsal that they have once a month on Sundays, right? Still learning the ropes here myself. But because right now South Shore Children's Chorus is located at two campuses, one in Quincy and one in Sharon, and we've had such great rejuvenation since we've gotten back to have this opportunity to start singing again, that we're immediately in the market, if you so will, to add another South Shore location in the very near future. We're actually in conversations with that right now, potentially in the Hanover-ish area. And one of the reasons why that Kirsten brought me on board was to help with the strategic planning and vision that she's already has in her head, and I just get to implement it.
So basically, she's going to kind of give you the vision, and you've got to kind of map this out.
And that is exactly why Kirsten described us as yin and yang last week, because she said that we fit so well together. That her her high, you know, skills are my low skills, and vice versa. So we're great together already. It's great.
So I would ask you this, and that is, what do you have coming up for the fall? Is it going to be basically full on? Because in the spring, you really didn't have much, did you?
No, we didn't. But we're looking to come back. We're rip-roaring ready to go. We're going back full force. We're ready to come in with these students and start singing and preparing for our winter concert in January of 2022.
And that's, I was going to ask you that. And that is you, I'm sure you geared this up where each group, as they are, whatever their experience is, they'll each have an opportunity to perform in one of these concerts?
Absolutely. Our concerts include all of our groups, and each of our concerts, it's really fun, actually, builds from the youngest group to the oldest group. So when you watch the concerts as an audience member or a parent, you're really seeing a curriculum. You're seeing growth from the bottom to the top. You're seeing these kindergarten through second graders, and the children themselves are seeing it to where they strive to one day be in the older group. They're so excited by the sound and by how they perform. So it's a really neat time. And then at the end of every concert, we always do one big piece that includes all the kiddos. And it's really fun.
And what's it like to plan something like that? Is that something that's the entire team comes together and you pick the pieces and how it all unfolds?
Absolutely. My artistic team and I, usually they come up with the pieces for their group. And then I come up with the pieces for my group, and I always conduct the final piece, and we kind of work together, and with a little bit of magic, it all kind of comes together, and the kids sing, and the people cry. It's a good time.
So how do you pick your pieces, and do the kids have any input on it, or is it basically what you feel they can handle?
They have this running joke about me and how I program. And I may have started my own running joke, but my favorite kind of way to program pieces is, and now for something completely different. I like to program really, really different repertoire all on one program. You never know when a student is only going to sing one concert with you when you run a program like this. You never know if their soccer team is going to make it impossible to continue, or their family situation, or they move away and all of a sudden they only have one concert to sing with you. So I try and pick sets of pieces that kind of hit all the marks. Slow, fast, in another language, from another culture. Really allowing every student to get a full experience every semester. So that way, no matter what life kind of throws, they walk away. They don't walk away saying, I only sang patriotic tunes, or I only sang songs about the spring, or any of that. It's really, they walk away saying, I sang these five pieces and they were awesome and so different. And I had to learn all of these different techniques to make that happen. And now I know so much more about my instrument and about myself.
And again, we are talking about the South Shore Children's Chorus. You were just listening to Kirsten Oberoi and Michelle McGrath as we're talking about this program, its growth. Let's dig a little deeper. Who are some of the people who inspired you, Kirsten, and were the building blocks for who you are?
Well, that one's a pretty easy one, actually. Okay. That was my mom. And my mom was a music educator in the South Shore. She was the director of music in Braintree for almost 30 years. And just an educator that cared more about her students than the music they created. And because she cared more about her students than the music they created was beautiful. And so I've kind of taken that philosophy on myself and realized that the joy comes first. The human comes first. The music will follow. And that's something that's been really inspiring to me.
Wow. I kind of felt a little inspired there myself. no, but it's so worldly. The way you said it, though, is I think it's dead on. Mm. You talked a little bit about strategic planning. What goes beyond the strategic planning? Then once you have the third location.
Sure.
Then what?
So what I'm tasked with.
Yes, right.
Location. We're just going to keep going. Well, one of the things that Kirsten has tasked me with is, like I said, creating some strategic planning for the future, but that also includes a 1, 3, and 5-year plan, and that's how I will spend kind of these remote hours the rest of this summer, like getting to know all the ropes and putting all of that infrastructure in place so that as the year rolls on and Kirsten is in rehearsals and I'm doing administrative work, I'm still fulfilling her goals for my role with the organization. And also, you know, like, improving upon some of the communication skills to parents, things like that, so that way we can make sure that we're creating an environment of satisfaction.
Absolutely. I mean, customer service all the way around. That's especially right. When you're talking about you're dealing with parents and
right.
and their children, and that's the future.
Right.
You want to definitely have clear communication skills when it comes to all the important parts to this.
And there's other, you know, there's other legs of that kind of growth and visionary portion of my work is to, as you know, I'm luckily connected to very many people in the South Shore in culture and arts. And
they call it networking. you are one heck of a networker.
Thank you, sir. And you know, I feel like there's an opportunity that's untapped here so far. This is a very unique organization and program. There is nothing like it in this area, largely because Kirsten is so committed to every child being able to sing, and it being non-auditioned. And so with that in mind, I feel like there's a lot of opportunities for community partnerships with this organization that we might be able to go maybe perform at senior centers, or maybe have a rehearsal there, or maybe take a choral tour down the road. We have like a lot of things that could potentially come out of this growth besides moving to new campuses.
But Kirsten, is there such thing as growing too fast? Because if you grow too fast, the ingredients can get lost. What do you think of that?
Nah.
Okay. I'm a fast-moving person.
But there's only one of you.
There's only one of me, which is why there's a Michelle. And that's a big growth for me personally. I've spent the past 5 years more or less doing everything for the organization on my own. And there are skills that I don't have that I've learned to have.
Time to delegate.
And it's time to delegate.
She is good at that. It's very good.
It's important to know your strengths, and it's important to know where other people are stronger than you are. I was just talking to Michelle out in the other room while we were waiting about, again, Kelly Graber, my training choir director, who's been working with me almost since the very beginning of the organization. And when I brought her on, I knew I wanted a class for kindergarten to second graders and had no experience teaching kindergarten to second graders. I'm a secondary educator. It's a different ball game. And so I found the very, very best educator that I could. And turns out she's a Quincy native and lives in Quincy and went through the system and loved the mission. And now she teaches for us. And I've learned so much from her. She has skills that I couldn't even dream of having and experiences that I don't even come close with that age group. So I think it's really important that as this grows, it can grow as fast as it wants, as long as I can continue to plug really, really excellent educators and people into this organization.
As I had said when we were corresponding back and forth, this segment can go really fast.
Yes.
And we have come to the point where probably there are people at home, at home are probably going, okay, I want to get involved. How do I do that? This is the time to share with folks if they want to get involved, if they want their children to get involved. What is the process like? Michelle, you want to kind of give us the details as to they have a child that they want to get involved with this program?
Absolutely, yes. So Kirsten is so on top of things that she already has the fall registration open on the website.
I see that on the website. Join us this fall.
Yes, and you can go right to the website and just click there and enter your information, and we'll get back to you and help, you know, help you navigate what it's like to join a choral organization, maybe as a new family. And there's other ways to get involved too, because volunteerism helps organizations like this an awful lot. And also donations. The board of South Shore Children's Chorus is very active, and they're ambitious, and they're doing really great things to support the organization, and there's certainly opening opportunities for people that might bring some skills there, and donations go a long way in helping with tuition assistance, and that can also be handled on the website as well.
Is it fair to say that this is a non-profit?
Yes.
Just want to make sure you're talking about donations.
Right.
And the website is, Kirsten?
www.southshorechildrenschorus.org.
And that was a teal. Was the colors. What's the color palette there?
Teal. Everything is teal.
Everything is teal.
Everything has been teal for 5 years.
Really?
My husband and I have a running joke. Everywhere we go, we'll go on vacation, and I'll be in a little tchotchke store, and I'll be like, ooh, and he goes, you're just looking at it because it's teal. You don't need it.
And the irony of this is my entire living room circulates around a gigantic teal sectional. It's almost like we were meant to work together over one color.
If you like teal, join the South Shore Children's Chorus. You will have plenty of teal in your wardrobe.
Anything that we haven't talked about, but you want to make sure that we mention before we say goodbye, for at least this segment.
Well, I guess I want to just talk about the singing part for a second.
Please do.
You know, I myself am a singer as an adult, and there are very few ways that you can source that kind of the feeling. I don't know how to completely put it into words, but it sources a feeling from deep inside of you that gives you fulfillment that you can't find in other ways. There certainly are other ways in the arts to find fulfillment, but when you use your voice to sing, you don't need any equipment or exterior materials. You just need maybe some music in front of you. You don't even need music sometimes. Sometimes you're sight singing, or you're just singing from rote, you know, and enjoying the opportunity to engage your voice and get a lot of peace in life. So I highly recommend it.
Anything you want to say in closing, Kirsten?
Yes. In closing, I think I would just like to remind anyone who's listening, if you have a child at home, not to get roped into the singing is only for the talented mindset, because it's not. Singing is a beautiful skill, and our society sometimes has pushed that people on YouTube or people on American Idol or all of these television shows are the talented. And quite frankly, they're not. You don't put your five-year-old on a soccer team because they're going to go play soccer professionally. You put a five-year-old on your soccer team because it brings them joy. And I would just really encourage you to consider music education a part of your child's entire well-being, and that here we are not looking for the cream of the crop singers. We are looking for that joy, and to bring that joy to your children and to give them that appreciation that singing and music can give to them. And if that's something that you want for your child, I would just really recommend that you come and you find out more about us.
I'm going to quote Drumline. Right?
Oh, right.
One band, one sound.
There you go.
Ladies, I want to thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Let's have you come back.
Yes, it would be wonderful.
Anytime.
Especially if you're going to tease a concert.
Yes, we have all kinds of things going on.
Have you come back, as we've had Kirsten Oberoi and Michelle McGrath. Tune in tomorrow. She's on. Michelle McGrath will be joining Rob Hackland in the South Shore's Morning News tomorrow morning, so tune in for that. And ladies, again, continued success.
Thank you.
We're going to step aside. When we come back, we're going to speak with the author of Pretty Girls Don't Get Cancer. M. Patricia Diaz will be my guest. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Deb's constipation with belly pain, discomfort, and bloating kept giving her grief. She talked to her doctor to get some relief. Turns out Deb had irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, or IBS-C, which was a start. Saying yes to Linzess helped her do her part.
Linzess, or linaclotide, is a prescription medicine that treats IBS-C in adults. Linzess works differently than laxatives. It lets you have more frequent and complete bowel movements and helps relieve overall abdominal symptoms, belly pain, discomfort, and bloating. These symptoms were studied in combination, not individually. Do not give Linzess to children less than 6, and it should not be given to children 6 to less than 18. It may harm them. Do not take Linzess if you have a bowel blockage. Get immediate help if you develop unusual or severe stomach pain, especially with bloody or black stools. The most common side effect is diarrhea, sometimes severe. If it's severe, stop taking Linzess and call your doctor right away. Other side effects include gas, stomach area pain, and swelling. There could be more to your story with IBS-C. Talk to a doctor today. Say yes to Linzess. Learn more at Linzess.com or call 1-800-LINZESS. Sponsored by Avi and Ironwood Pharmaceuticals.
Buying, selling, or trading in a car? Learn from the experts how to make the process work for you. Tune into the Boss Auto Show every Saturday after the news at noon on 95.9 WATD. Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We have arrived at the final segment of Monday Night Talk, heard right here on 95.9 WATD. Our final guest for this evening is an author of the book, Pretty Girls Don't Get Cancer. We have Patricia Diaz, who is joining us, and she is someone who survived stage 4 terminal cancer. And she actually sat down and wrote a book about, you know, getting this diagnosis and what it was like. Patricia, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So the first thing I would ask you is that knowing that when you hear such earth-shattering news that you have a disease and... you know, you're young. You were young, 16 years old, if I'm correct. What is that? What goes through your head as an adolescent, you know, to hear that kind of news?
If I look back at that moment, my world kind of stopped at that moment. And I was in pretty bad shape. So I almost wanted to be freed from everything I was living at that time. And I wrote this scene in the book where I'm seeing the beach and wanting to just fly like a seagull. And I just wanted to be free from the shackles of what I was living. But then I heard my sister's voice kind of drawing me back and said, you know, but for our creator, it's the same to cure a cold and to cure a terminal disease. All we just have to do is believe. After that, there was no going back. I was in it. So even if I wanted to change anything, I couldn't. That was my reality. So I had nothing else to do but just face it.
So as you're, I understand that it was kind of a bit of a trial and error and a lifestyle adjustment. Is this wasn't just necessarily where you're like, well, anything that is going to help me cure this, but what was the process like for you to find something that would help you or heal you, or at least put you in remission, mind, body, and spirit?
So it was a long process. There were certain things that kept coming in, and certain words like forgiveness and meditation and breathing and things like that. And they were coming in drops, and it was a lot of times it was overwhelming because I didn't know if I was doing enough, if what I was doing was okay and it was going to heal me. I was blind. I just didn't know what was going to work or what wasn't going to work. So I kept hearing things and trying things, and whatever resonated with me, I kept on trying and trying and practicing. So it was a learning process. It wasn't like, you know, well, now you have to meditate and I will sit there and meditate and it worked. No, it was a lot of trial and errors, a lot of roller coaster rides of emotional roller coaster rides of this doesn't work, I'm not going to try that, yes, this works, I want to try it, and just head on, like the forgiveness therapy I did with a psychotherapist. And that's in the book, so I won't talk too much about that. But yes, it was trial and error. Some things I just felt in my heart that I needed that I wanted that. And of course, there was also the medical side that the doctors were in charge of, and I let them do what they needed to do.
It's worth noting that you are 30 years in remission. Is that accurate?
30 plus years, yes.
I'm 30 not plus
anymore.
Okay. So to say, you know, when did you decide that you wanted to share your experience with others who might be enduring something similar, whether it's someone who is as young as you were or just someone who gets a diagnosis that you have stage 4 cancer and it's terminal?
So this story has been nagging me for a long time, wanting to come out, wanting for me to write it. I have always been busy and working and this and occupied in multiple different things, so I kept shutting it down. Finally, it was in a phase of unemployment where I used that fuel of that rejection fuel of like the world doesn't care about me anymore. And I used all that to learn how to write a memoir in English. And well, you know, the story came out, and it was 30 years later. On top of that, when I was going through it and when I was learning all of the mindfulness and alternative therapies, I didn't know if any of that was going to work. So I didn't feel at that time that I was an authority, that I could talk about it. And now it kind of feels like, okay, it's worked, you know, for good or for bad, I don't know. Some of those strategies have worked to keep the inflammation down and keep me healthy. So I wrote about it, and, you know, whoever can benefit from those techniques and from the research I did back then, you know, so be it. I love it.
So you have added author to your title. but what else, what has your career, what is your career path? What do you do when you aren't penning an award-winning book?
Oh, gosh. Well, I get to interview with Kevin. I get to talk to very different, amazing people about the experience, and share the story. Also get to volunteer in cancer organizations. I've cooked for cancer organizations before for week-long retreats. I've taught yoga. I've spoken to folks in those cancer organizations or support cancer organizations. So it's one side of my career right now that I love, and has always been very quiet, but now it's resurfacing.
And again, if you are just joining us, we are speaking with Patricia Diaz, and we're talking with her about her book, Pretty Girls Don't Get Cancer, as she shares the details of being an adolescent, 16 years old, and having a doctor being blunt, saying you have cancer, and it doesn't look good at this particular time. You talk about writing a book and deciding to start doing documentation. How long did it take for you to kind of at least gather all the information and everything that you had gone through, so you can kind of compile this into a help aid to someone else who may be dealing with something that you endured?
Well, to be honest, it took a lot of years. I think the first version or the first few chapters I wrote probably like 10 years ago. And then it was only like 4 years ago or 3 years ago when my sister went to Venezuela, where we used to live, and she brought my journals back then. And that really got all the information that I needed, because it gave me times, it gave me feelings, emotions, and things that I specifically wrote back then. And that really helped me write the book in a more I guess more closer to what was the reality back then. So I took those emotions and put them in the book. And then I wrote that first draft, and it's like that very ugly first draft that you have to pretty much throw away. And then I joined the writers group, and they helped me with my writing skills, and out came the book, and that was the second draft.
And what was that? What was that like? What led you? What really led you to? Was it after you completed the first draft and having others view it and look at it, like going, okay, maybe I need to go speak with folks who write, so I can better articulate what I went through, to be able to communicate what I endured?
Well, I actually spoke with a mentor that I know from one of the companies that I worked on before. And when I had about 30,000 words, I talked to her, and she said, "Patricia, to be considered halfway serious, you have to write at least 60,000 words." So I closed myself. I enclosed myself in a room, in a hotel room, and all I did was write for a month. And then that's when the first draft came. And then she kept giving me tips. Well, now, you know, your writing is okay. You really need to focus on these things. And I would encourage you to join a writer's group. So I did. And it was the best thing I did, because they really gave me chapter by chapter a very good critique of the pages of the book and my writing style. And that was the Creative Washington meetup at the time. They've changed their names, but incredible. I give them credits also in my book because of all the help that they gave me in writing and my writing skills. Towards the end, they even said, "Your writing skills are completely different from when you started." So that was helpful.
What do you feel were some of the most helpful tips that helped you grow as a writer, as a storyteller, and anybody, I mean, I've done writing, and there comes times when sometimes the words will just flow on the page, and then there's other times where, like, you can't get past two sentences.
Right. Well, focusing on the scene and on the moment of the scene and describing things so that and it's almost like a painting. You know, when you want to draw the attention on certain things, you highlight those colors. Well, the same thing is with words. And that was something I got from them. You know, paint those things that you really want to highlight. You know, what was the temperature like? What was the color, the room, the words? How did you feel? Be more specific. I was using narration too much in my first draft, so I narrated instead of talking in first person. And talking in first person is very hard because you run that risk of being coming across a little arrogant. And so it's finding that right balance between writing about the people around you, the scenes, and how you felt with everything that was going on around you.
So I would ask you, would you say is English your first language, or what is your first language?
Spanish.
So was there any at any point in time where you maybe thought about writing a book in Espanol, and maybe that would have been an easier process?
That would have been so much easier to write my book in Spanish. Now I'm writing it in Spanish, and I tell you, it's like writing a second book. It's completely different. The Spanish is more circular. There's just different ways of saying things. So you can't just grab the book and translate it in Google and that's it. No, it's just a completely different book in Spanish.
But would the process and the storytelling be similar, or is it because of how you may phrase things in Spanish, it's completely different as it is in English?
So the story is a story. Probably the story arcs are slightly different. And also the phrasing, of course, is different. So the way you describe things, the descriptors go in different places in the sentence. So if I translate it word by word, it's gonna feel very robotic. people are probably going to understand it, but it's going to be robotic. If in order for it to be artistic, it has to be a different book.
Okay. What were some of the other things that you learned about as being an author and putting this book together? Was it a matter of placement, if you had photographs, picking a cover? What were some of the other things that you were able to help yourself become an award-winning author?
Gosh, it's a hard question. I put a lot of my heart in that book, and I chose every single word, every single picture that I wanted in there. So choosing the scenery, and then choosing the person that was going to do all the art part, that was fun, because he's an artist, and he's somebody I know from Venezuela. And he was able to capture some of the thoughts that I had of indigenous art, right? And you can see some of that indigenous art, very simple, but colorful in the book. So he captured that really well. And that's, you know, I just love that. The whole process was hard because I never have done it before, but it was fun to discover it.
You know, reading, doing a little reading up on your book and you yourself and the details of the book. One of the phrases that I came across in regards to you telling your story was that there were times that you actually did not sugarcoat what you went through. What was it like to kind of give, you know, put realism in your story so that folks understand that you're not just being a storyteller, but you're trying to share your agony through words?
Yeah. You know, connecting with the moment of my first chemotherapy, for example, when I wrote about it the first time, I almost didn't want to write about it. And my, the writing group said, you know, what was it like, really? Like, you have to tell us, when you went through it, you felt that the chemicals going through, how did your body feel? All of that, I had to kind of relive the whole thing, and it wasn't pleasant. But in order for the actual message to come across of the book, I had to paint that horror story very well. So, a lot of times I actually had to relive some of the things, like when my hair fell, you know, how did I feel? And these were memories that were tucked away that I hadn't relived in such a long time. But it was almost therapeutic for me to go back and go through them again and forgive some of those episodes in my life. And I don't mean because I did anything wrong. I mean forgiveness as in, okay, I let it go.
when you know, I think anytime we as human beings, anytime we're going through a traumatic experience in our life, whether it has to do with our health, whether it has to do with day-to-day operations in our lives, family and friends can be adversely affected by it. And I would believe that you had to share stories about, you know, some of your tougher times, how the illness was affecting you, and how it affect, you know, and how it affected your family. What was it like to share those stories and then have your family see it and actually have them vet it out and go, yeah, that's exactly what it was like?
Well, you know, I kept the story as me telling it from my point of view. So I tried not to get too biased by their opinions, right, when I was writing it, because I wanted to keep my point of view as a central point. As, you know, when my sister was doing things and when my brother was doing things, that's how I saw them, right? They might have a different view and a different story to tell. During the whole story, I try to keep my point. For the most part, so my father read it cover to cover. I think some of my siblings haven't read it completely. I, you know, it's they have their reasons, right? My father sometimes will make a comment, well, that part wasn't like that, and I said, well, that's how I saw it. For the most part, he says it's pretty accurate.
If you are just tuning into this segment, we're speaking with Patricia Diaz. She is the author of Pretty Girls Don't Get Cancer. Don't get fooled by the title itself. It's a fantastic cover, and it's a fantastic story of somebody who has found a way to persevere and is sharing that story. Do you feel that that a part of the putting the book together was also to at least share positive vibes with the reader, that if in fact this is something that happens to you or a family member, that the power of positivity is something that can be very medicinal?
Absolutely. There are, even though it is a very hard topic of crisis, family crisis, there are a lot of very positive messages in that book. The power of community, the power of prayer, believe, the power of friends, being there for one another, and having an open mind to learn new things during that process, and giving yourself the permission to be sad, to cry when you need to laugh. So going, riding the wave of the illness as best you can and as graceful as you can, knowing that you will fall down. But yes, today I'm a completely different diet than what I had back then. And I just feel good and feel healthy with energy. So it's changed me for the positive.
So we got a few more minutes left with you, here, Patricia. And that is, all right, so you get your final draft all together. You're ready to, you've picked your cover art and you're sending it off to have the first edition printed. What was that like? And what was it like to get the hard copy in your hands from the publisher?
Yeah, finally. I hugged it. I cried. Joy tears, of course. It was an emotional moment that I finally, whatever happens to the book, it's beyond me, right? But I did it. I finally completed what that nagging voice was telling me I needed to do. So it felt really well, good.
So if folks who are tuned into this this program, this segment, want to know how they can get a copy now, where is it available these days to be able, if someone wanted to purchase a copy?
Sure. Thank you for that. It's in Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, Walmart, Target, Book Baby. So multiple venues, places that can be purchased. You just put the name. You can put my name or the name of the book, and you'll get several options there, whatever preference you have. It's available in ebook and also in hard copy.
Okay. English right now and Spanish later, or both?
Yeah, English right now, Spanish, I'm hoping sometime soon. I'm still writing it.
Okay. And a couple of times I've referred to your book as being an award-winning book. My understanding is that it actually received a bronze medal from the 2021 Independent Publishers Book Awards. Yeah. What's that like for it to be recognized? For somebody who didn't realize she'd be writing a book about, the experience she was dealing with cancer, to someone who is being recognized by a publisher.
Put the topic aside and the book aside, it was just a validation of writing. And I'm incredibly honored and happy about the prize, the award. It was a surprise because I entered it mostly for the feedback and to get the experience, right? So it was a very pleasant surprise that I actually won it, and it felt really good. It's a validation that I can write good English.
Yeah, now if folks be, you know, fast become a fan of yours, now have you set up a website, or is there a way for them to follow you on social media?
Absolutely. My website is mpatriciadiaz.com. And you'll have, you can see all the social media there. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook as well.
Okay. And I think you've kind of said that you're technically kind of writing your second book. Knowing that you've kind of really got a grasp of writing, is there a chance that, depending on how well this book is received, that there could be another book in the works?
I think so. I want to. Yes, definitely. I'm throwing some ideas around what that might be. But I definitely want to keep writing. And it's something that I found that I like to do a lot. So I think it's brewing. I don't know what it's going to be yet.
Okay. And now we're at that point in time in our conversation as we get ready to wrap it up. And I'll ask you a couple of final questions. And that is, if you were to impart a little wisdom on some of the folks who are out there writing for their first time, if you could share a tip with them or just give a little bit of advice to help nudge them along, what would you share with them for for a tip or two?
For a tip, I would say write as if nobody else was going to read it and just pour your heart and soul in there and let that be whatever is going to be. And then find a mentor that can help you really through that writing process, the creative process, as well as the book industry process. Maybe it's a different mentor for each one of those, but find people that can help you along the way, because if you're writing for the first time, the process can be frustrating when you don't know what you don't know. And if you're anything like me, I want to write and then, okay, I'm published. So I want to see the end result right away. But it's longer than I thought it would ever be. And it the process is just, so there's so many unknowns that help is very needed and helpful. Yeah.
So we're wrapping up now. Anything you want to say in closing to my audience?
Oh gosh, thank you for the support. I appreciate you buying the book, supporting the effort. I will let you know that part of the proceeds will go to cancer research. As of course I was impacted, my family was impacted, so I that's something that's very near and dear to my heart. My time as well as funds are going to cancer research. So thank you for supporting me.
Again, we've been speaking with the author of Pretty Girls Don't Get Cancer with Patricia Diaz. Patricia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that will do it for tonight's program. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., thank you for tuning in to Monday Night Talk. Have yourself a great night.